Sunday night edition of Warrior Connection. This is Doug Rocky, and we have a stormy night here in Illinois, so we'll continue on and have a very interesting program. Tonight, it is a distinct pleasure. I have John Steinbach, who is the number one expert on the discussion of the Israel's nuclear armament, and also Iran's nuclear programs. This is a guy that writes the papers, does the reports, and everything else. As we go into this and everything runs headlong into possible combat operations between Iran and Israel, I think it's extremely important for everybody to understand what's happening. So that's going to be our program tonight. First off, Denise, if you're here, can you give us an update?
Yeah, I've got two items tonight, basically, and we always want to remember one of our Gulf War veterans. And I have Kevin E. Donahue out of, I believe, Sacramento, California. I don't have cause of death, but he was born February 2nd, 1969, and he died April 29th, 2012. There's no cause of death, but he was a Gulf War veteran, an owner of his own business in Sacramento. So we want to remember him. We do not always have info of if they died of cancer or a heart attack or what, but this is continuing on, as you and I both know. So I wanted to remember him as representing all Gulf War vets that are dying much too soon in life, and we definitely need to push the VA to get these people compensated. It's been 21 years, and we need to improve the care that they are receiving. And the research will go on, I'm sure, and hopefully help our OIF, OEF vets of some of the exposures that we shared with them. Now, there is one bill that's kind of languished every year. It's been introduced several times, and Representative Serrano introduced this back in January of last year. So we work on a 2-year period in the Hill. If it doesn't go anywhere, it gets reintroduced again. And this is Bill H.R. 248, people. And it's to provide for identification of members of the armed forces exposed during military service to depleted uranium, provide for health testing of such members and for other purposes. We need adequate testing of these people, and which test they would use. We know that we shouldn't be doing the urine testing that Bethesda's doing. We need more advanced testing, but depleted uranium could be the cause of a lot of problems. Number one that shoots in my mind is getting data on cancers. And we're going to see more and more cancers popping as we go along for the Gulf War vets, but yet no cancers have been presumed connected. So I feel like we need to push for this bill. We need to show that there's other support. So I'm encouraging veterans, civilians, to write in to their representatives and ask them to get on and co-sponsor this. This is something that's been introduced year in and year out, Doug. As you know, we've had several of these bills introduced, and they've never passed. We're 21 years into it. We're out of Iraq now, and it is time for action to be taken, and the right action. We need testing. We need the data on cancers. We need some connections being made for the benefit of our vets.
That's extremely important. I mean, at the end of Desert Storm, I had over 400 individuals that were involved in the depleted uranium cleanup operations, and I had right around 123 that survived friendly fire, and they're still not getting medical care. And again, that's confirmed again in the brand new VA Gulf War illness report. Anyhow, thank you, Denise. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my distinct pleasure, with the help of Patricia Axelrod, to have John Steinbach on tonight. John, are you there?
So I'm right here, Doug.
God bless you. Thank you, John. John, for all our listeners, I mean, this is extremely important. I mean, we're running headlong into another possible conflict between the United States and Iran, between Israel and Iran. And I think we have to look at what's happening with all the nuclear programs and all of the information that's put out there. John, could you give us a little bit about your background, how you got involved in this, and then start telling the story of what we have first from Israel and then go on to Iran, please, sir?
Well, my background is I grew up in a small farm town in Michigan, Dexter, Michigan. Out of high school, in 1965, I graduated, joined the Coast Guard, and was in active duty for 4 years, 2 years in the North Pacific, and 2 years search and rescue. And it was really my experience, especially in the North Pacific, in Hawaii and Yokosuka, Japan, that really opened my eyes. And it was veterans. It was veterans like yourself, and in their own sense, they were whistleblowers like you. People that I would run into, Marines from Kaneohe and Air Force people from Hickam and Navy guys, people who'd been in Vietnam, soldiers from Vietnam, and they opened my eyes about, you know, lies that were being told by the government way back then. And it was that that really politicized me. It opened my eyes and made me question what I was told. And so I started questioning and became involved in the anti-war movement. I became involved in the food co-op movement, alternative economics, and also got involved in the anti-nuclear power movement because they were building a Fermi 2 nuclear plant near Detroit. So that was my beginning. Then I married Louise Franklin Ramirez. She had was one of the founding members of Women's Strike for Peace, and she was heavily involved in anti-nuclear weapons work. So I brought my anti-nuclear power work to the anti-nuclear weapons work. And I was also heavily involved back in the 70s in the anti-apartheid movement. And so there I became educated about the South African nuclear program and the connections between the South African program and the Israeli program and the Iranian nuclear program. So in a sense, that was the beginning. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in Environmental Studies from the University of Michigan. I've done quite a bit of postgraduate work at George Mason. I've written a number of articles on nuclear power, nuclear weapons issues. I also, because I live here in Virginia in Prince William County, I'm heavily involved in the immigrant solidarity movement, and I've also written an article for Z Magazine on Obama's immigration policy. So I've done quite a bit of writing over the years.
It's pretty incredible. I think tonight what we'd like to focus on, and I had the opportunity to read this, you wrote the report for the Washington Report comparing Israel's and Iran's nuclear programs. I mean, this is a seminal paper in the whole thing. Could you please start out a little bit of discussion and talk about Israel's program, how it began, what's involved, and where it's heading, please?
And there are parallels. Let me start with the parallels between Israel's and Iran's nuclear programs. So they both had their genesis in Israel's case, actually in the late 40s, in Iran's case in the middle 1950s with the advent of the Atoms for Peace program, Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace program. And in fact, the Mohammad Mossadegh was deposed with a CIA coup the same year that Eisenhower gave the Atoms for Peace program. And the Shah immediately took advantage, sent thousands of Iranian students to the U.S. to study nuclear engineering. So at exactly that same time, Israel was in the process of initiating its own nuclear program. So it also took advantage of the Atoms for Peace program, sent a number of Israeli students to the U.S. to study. Interestingly enough, both the first Israeli reactor and the first Iranian reactor were identical five megawatt highly enriched uranium research reactors, and in both cases, that 5 megawatt experimental reactor became the cornerstone of both the Israeli and the Iranian nuclear programs. So I just wanted to say that to say that there are parallels, strong parallels between both programs. But having said that, there are some pretty extreme differences. And so the Israeli program began actually in the late 1940s. It was the brainchild of a scientist by the name of David Bergman, and a politician that I think most of the listeners are familiar with, Shimon Peres. And it's very clear from the research that initially that the impetus for the Israeli program was the memory of the recent Holocaust. There were lots of quotes from Peres, from Bergman, from others. Jews will no longer be led like lambs to slaughter in reference to developing a nuclear weapon. So Israel became heavily invested in nuclear research. In the 1950s, they received their 5-megawatt reactor, and they began systematic nuclear research, but always with the propaganda message that this is peaceful research. This is to develop nuclear reactors, to develop nuclear energy, to develop medical uses of radioactive isotopes, and so on. And in the meantime, Israeli scientists were meeting in a fairly clandestine manner with a French nuclear scientists, and by the late 1950s, early 1960s, the Israeli and the French nuclear programs were virtually indistinguishable. What I like to say is that listeners should not consider that that France was instrumental in Israel's gaining the bomb, that it was French technology, French expertise that gave Israel the bomb. It was really a partnership. So when you had, in the early 60s, the French first testing their nuclear device in Algeria, you had many high-level Israeli scientists that were there on site behind the instrument panels, fully, not just monitoring, but fully participating in the first French nuclear tests. And in my opinion, those tests were as much Israeli tests as they were French tests.
So in other words, very simply, you have the French and Israeli scientists, very brilliant men, working together in unison to develop the French weapons.
Collaboration. So this is the early years. France signed a contract with Israel to build a reactor at Dimona. And this was nominally had a power of 20 megawatts. So it wasn't really big, but it had an additional capacity. It had an oversized cooling capacity, which could triple or quadruple the size of the reactor. And in fact, that's what happened. And I think that the important thing to understand is that there when this reactor was built, there was no provision for this reactor to supply any electricity to the Israeli electrical grid. On top of that, the reactor included a full plutonium reprocessing facility that was built right into the plans for the reactor. And in fact, the reactor is only part of a huge complex that was largely built by the French that extends 7 stories underground in the Negev desert. And one of those stories includes a plutonium reprocessing plant. So you have the reactor. The reactor is designed to produce plutonium. You have a plutonium reprocessing center. You have no electrical connection. So it's very clear. It's crystal clear, unequivocally clear, that France knew that they were building a bomb factory for Israel. And in fact, that's what happened. So Israel, then Dimona was finished around 1964 and went out of line, and the U.S. government became somewhat concerned. In fact, even earlier, the U.S. government had been concerned. Kennedy had been concerned. He'd sent scientists there. Israel stonewalled them. And then Johnson came to power. Johnson was more lenient about, about Israel in general and about Israel's nuclear power program in particular. But the U.S. was still concerned, was still sending inspectors there. The Israelis went to great extremes to fool the American inspectors. So they, when they built the reactor, they purchased three separate control room assemblies. So one was put in the Dimona reactor, and that was the actual control panel. Then the other control panel was put on site, but it was a dummy control panel. So when the U.S. scientists and the lower six stories were blocked off, so all they were seeing was the reactor itself, and they were seeing a dummy control panel. All of this is very spelled out in great detail in Seymour Hersh's book, The Samson Option. So listeners, go out, read that book. I deal with that in my article as well, but not in the depth that Seymour Hersh did. So for the American scientists, were somewhat fooled, not totally fooled. The intelligence services also were somewhat fooled, and so you had a situation where Israel had the capability of building nuclear bombs, and in fact, very quickly the Israelis did build nuclear devices, let's say, usable nuclear devices. They were crude atomic bombs. There were at least two that were produced in time for the 1967 war. And there, by the time that the 1972 war came around, there were several dozen nuclear weapons that had been produced. Golda Meir met with Richard Nixon in the late 1960s, and it was then that you saw the deal that was made between the U.S. and Israel. And that the deal essentially was, if Israel doesn't go public about its nuclear capability, that the U.S. will go along with it. They'll go along with the facade. And so that was the initial deal. Then Shimon Peres gave his famous speech in the early 70s saying Israel will not be the first to introduce nuclear weapons. I believe that was 1973. Of course, by then, Israel already had a significant nuclear arsenal. And So, Doug, feel free to jump in if you have any questions or need any clarification.
Now, one of the things I was thinking, so Israel has developed a nuclear arsenal. Do they use this both fission and fusion, or what type of bombs have they developed, and what are their delivery systems?
Let me finish the story then. Let me continue. So by the early 1980s, Israel had, in retrospect, we know now, had a significant arsenal, and it was very sophisticated. Referencing Seymour Hersh's work, in the early 1980s, an Israeli whistleblower. Came to the CIA and told the CIA about the Israeli nuclear program. The CIA was astounded. They couldn't believe that Israel had this sophisticated of a system. Nothing was known about this at the time. And it's looking back, it's not clear that the those high up in this decision-making structure of the CIA and the NSA really understood the implications of what they'd been told, or perhaps that they actually believed it. But then in 1986 came the smoking gun. There was a technician, a plutonium technician by the name of Mordecai Vanunu, who worked in Dimona. He was a leftist. He was a Palestine solidarity supporter, and he was appalled at what he saw. And so what he did is he took a large number of photographs while he was working in the plutonium reprocessing center and other parts of the Dimona plant, literally hundreds of photographs. And he took these photographs. He took them with him to Australia. He attempted to get them published there, but didn't find an interest. And then he approached the Sunday London Times. And the Sunday London Times was interested. Vanunu went to England, and the Sunday London Times looked at the photographs. They didn't fully understand what they were looking at, so they hired Ted Taylor and Frank Barnaby. And Taylor and Barnaby were both important figures in the Manhattan Project, and important figures in the U.S. A-bomb effort, and in Barnaby's case, the British A-bomb effort. Ted Taylor was one of the paramount bomb designers. He was the one who figured out how to really miniaturize nuclear weapons. And Barnaby was, both of them were highly, highly respected physicists and scientists. And they analyzed these photographs. And they came to the conclusion that Israel, this is 1986. Their conclusion was that Israel had at least 200 nuclear weapons, that these weapons were sophisticated weapons, that they included tactical and strategic weapons, and that they included boosted fission devices. These would be bombs that would be much larger, say, than the bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And Barnaby was convinced, because of the presence of certain isotopes that were being used in the process, that Israel also had the hydrogen bomb, the thermonuclear bomb. So with the support of these two world-class scientists, Sunday London Times went public with it. Your listeners can look all this up on the Internet. The Israelis sent a Mossad agent who introduced herself to Vanunu in England, and she lured him onto a yacht in the Mediterranean, and the yacht was then taken by the Israeli special forces. Vanunu was kidnapped, taken to Israel. He was found guilty of treason. He served 18 years in prison, served 11 years in solitary. At one point, Amnesty International said that he had served longer in solitary than any known prisoner in the entire world. Several years ago, he was released, but in essence, he's under house arrest, and really, in essence, is still in prison. And so therefore, we know a lot about the Israeli program, a lot of it having to do with Vanunu, but also research that's been done by Jane's Defense Weekly, Center for Defense Information, the Stockholm Peace Research Institute, Federation of American Scientists. And so we know that Israel has a very sophisticated, not only very sophisticated weapons, but a very sophisticated delivery system. So they have long intermediate range nuclear missiles. They have the Jericho 1, Jericho 2, which has a range of about 2,500 miles. They also have the Jericho 3, which is in development. You have to remember that we heard all this brouhaha a few months ago about the North Korean attempt to launch a satellite. Well, if North Korea can launch a satellite, they're capable of building an ICBM. Well, Israel launched a satellite over 10 years ago. When they launched it, they deliberately launched the satellite against the rotation of the Earth. And it takes much, much more of payload power to launch a satellite against the rotation of the Earth. So, I'm assuming that Israel was sending a message at that point saying, you know, look, you know, and they were successful, unlike North Korea. So they're saying, look, you know, we can do this. So they have ballistic missiles that can reach beyond Moscow, can reach most of Africa, can reach all of the Middle East, much of Southeast Asia. They have bombers that are capable of going to and from Tehran, round trip without refueling. And maybe most importantly, they have a fleet of submarines. And these are submarines that were built by Germany. They have three of them that have been delivered. Two more are being delivered this year. These are all nuclear-capable submarines. The two new ones are capable of over 10,000, a cruising radius of over 10,000 miles.
Wow.
And they can operate because of their special fuel cell technology, can operate underwater for several weeks at a time without coming to the surface. The last thing I want to say about the Israeli program is that one of these submarines is pretty much constantly patrolling the Red Sea area off the coast of Iran.
Now, one thing that I know from firsthand experience during Operation Desert Storm in December, January, and February, as the Iraqis started launching their missiles, the Scud attacks all over the area and specifically into Israel, we had an absolute promise that with the first confirmed chemical or biological missile Scud that hit Israel that we would have a full nuclear attack. And so we were totally involved, and I was at the 3rd MedCom headquarters and involved in NBC at that time, as everybody knows, and we were absolutely told to start plotting the nuclear fallout patterns for the probable Israeli strike as far as where would the fallout and everything, what would happen, what would the effects of the nuclear blast be on all the coalition troops. So we absolutely did that. Thank God for Schwarzkopf and Powell and Zulus and the whole group there. You know, we didn't have any direct chemical sludge in Israel, and we didn't have Israel launch their nuclear strike. So I know that's
right.
Firsthand,
right.
What I know.
Well, and don't forget, at that time, you know, we had been told that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and we knew from the Iranian-Iraq war that Iraq, unlike Iran, by the way, Iraq did use chemical weapons to attack villages in Iran.
Absolutely.
And kill tens of thousands of people with those weapons. So even those such as myself who were very skeptical that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, you know, mainly because of the UN inspectors that were there who said, you know, that they don't, a lot of us still thought, well, maybe they have a little bit. And for those of us familiar with the Israeli nuclear policy, their policy is unequivocal, and that is that if they are attacked by missiles, you know, that they will respond. They will assume that those missiles are carrying chemical weapons or biological weapons, and that they will respond with nuclear weapons.
So to me, what
happened is that the U.S. government went to the mat with Israel at that time and told Israel, you know, do not retaliate with nuclear weapons, even though Iraq is striking at EU, at least as long as there are no, you know, weapons of mass destruction involved. And Seymour Hersh told us about this again. Seymour Hersh also made the point that this was a special case and had to do with a specific situation and direct U.S. Jawboning of Israel, and that won't happen again. And if Israel is attacked with Scud missiles or with more sophisticated missiles, and certainly Iran's missiles are much more sophisticated than the ones that that Iraq used, then all bets would be off, and that that the Israeli nuclear strategy would dictate that Israel would respond with nuclear weapons against Iran.
So I guess the next part of this equation now is Iran. And
yes,
if you can talk about Iran, what was known to have, where they're at with their program, and then obviously we got to go into the probability of all this. So how about Iran now, John? Talk about Iran, please.
Well, and we talked a little bit, Doug, at the beginning about the parallels. So, and again, going back to the beginning, the program began in the late 1950s. The Iranians got their first reactor in the 1960s, in the mid-1960s, research reactor. The Shah sent many, many students to the U.S. to study nuclear engineering. And the plan was that Iran would build a grand total of 20 nuclear reactors for electricity production, with a total output of 23 megawatts of electricity. They signed two contracts, one with Germany to build two reactors in Bushehr, and then also they signed a contract with the French to build two more reactors. So they had four reactors on the planning board or in the process of being built. There were problems that the Shah had, one of which, a big one, and this is also, by the way, a problem that the Israelis had as well, and both of them, you know, went to the same customer in essence, which is South Africa, and in both cases gave South Africa technology and money. In the case of Israel and Iran, reprocessing or fuel enrichment technology to enrich the natural uranium in return for the South Africa's giving Iran and Israel the natural uranium. But they didn't. Iran did not have the capability of enriching uranium. So what the Shah did is he lent a European consortium over $1 billion to build an enrichment facility in France. And the contract was that in return for this $1 billion, that Iran would get 10% of the enriched uranium to fuel their reactors. So they also, the U.S. offered to, and this is, we're talking the mid-60s now, offered to provide Iran with a plutonium reprocessing facility, because the back then the idea was that the nuclear technology would go the avenue of breeder reactors and using plutonium to fuel the reactors instead of just enriched uranium in order to so-called close the fuel cycle. So all of these promises were made to Iran, but as the 70s wore on, concerns arose in having to do with apparent plans by the Shah to develop a nuclear weapons program. So that made the U.S. very nervous. So they put pressure to bear on France. So France completed the enrichment facility, but never gave Iran any of the enriched uranium and never paid them back the $1 billion. The offer of the plutonium reprocessing facility was withdrawn. The French and the Germans were pressured into stopping construction on the reactor. And so at that point in the late 70s, the Iranian nuclear program was in total disarray. Then came the overthrow of the Shah, the Iranian Revolution. And during the first years of the revolution, in the early 80s, the nuclear program was not reinstituted. The Ayatollah Khomeini was adamantly opposed to nuclear power, and even more adamantly opposed to nuclear weapons. And in fact, he issued a fatwa, which is a religious decree with the effect of law, saying that the production and the possession of nuclear weapons was against Islam, that this was something that couldn't be done. And so it was not until near the time that Khomeini died that the Israeli nuclear power program was reinstituted. The nuclear weapons program may have been reinstituted, but according to the National Intelligence Estimate in 2007, and then again a couple of years later, the official, the CIA, NSA said that there had been no that the nuclear any nuclear weapons plans had been shelved in 2003. And that was backed up by the International Atomic Energy Agency. The International Atomic Energy Agency, under the pressure from the United States and NATO, insisted that Iran undergo the most intensive regimen of internal nuclear inspections of any government in the world. These incredibly intensive investigations are still continuing as we speak, up to the latest IAEA document. There is no evidence that Iran has any active nuclear weapons program. There's no evidence whatsoever.
I think
there are concerns. The concerns have to do with whether or not Iran was obligated to tell the IAEA about certain facilities that it was building prior to them actually producing enriched uranium, and also certain files that the IAEA wanted produced that Iraq says don't exist, having to do with the former nuclear weapons program. So, and that's kind of where we are right now. In my opinion, when we look at the sanctions, when we look at the proclamations coming out of the IAEA, particularly since Mohammed Alberdi has left the IAEA as the chair of the president of the IAEA, that a lot of what we're seeing amounts to political posturing. And if you actually look at and analyze their reports, nothing has changed.
It's frightening to think, you know, what is going on, because so we're looking at is we know Israel, and we can see justifiably so, has an incredible nuclear weapons program. They
right.
have complete delivery systems, and again, the Holocaust, there's no doubt about it. I had to teach the Holocaust again recently in my school class, and even for me to reteach about, think about to the new generation is totally frightening beyond all imagination. So I can understand that from that point. So we're looking at now with Iran. Again, the facilities, as we know, just the U.S. facilities, the French facilities, England, wherever we have it, the facilities necessary just for enrichment to get the weapons grade and everything are incredibly huge. You can't bury them in a little hole in the ground or in a building below the surface. It's just not even possible.
No, it's not possible, and it's not possible to do this in secrecy. And certainly Iran is not the only government in the world to enrich uranium. We have several dozen nations around the world that have uranium enrichment facilities. Iran has it's kind of a middle range enrichment process. They use centrifuges. They don't use the most modern technology. Most of their enrichment is at the 5% level, which is what's used for fuel rods for conventional nuclear power plants. They're also enriching a smaller amount, up to 20%, and that's the amount that's necessary for a medical reactor. Iran has one medical reactor, and that's used to generate medical isotopes for medical processes. And radioactive medical isotopes are very, very difficult to get over the counter, so to speak. So from their point of view, it's a public health issue.
So I guess with the medical isotopes, given what we do know, that Iraq did use all these weapon systems on Iran, the cancers and everything, that's legendary now, incredible problems. So the radioactive medical isotopes are absolutely essential for health, so we can understand that.
Right.
And so
right.
I guess we're coming down to this whole thing. Right now, and it's been going on for years and years and months, and I know I've been involved in discussions and everything, is the posturing on the Western side against Iran with the probability of direct attacks onto Iran. I mean, Israel has already destroyed one Iranian reactor before. There's no doubt it could happen again.
Yeah, they destroyed the Iraqi reactor, the Osiris reactor, in the early 1970s. But when we're talking about Iran, comparing Iran with Iraq, we need to remember that Iran is a much larger country than Iraq. It has a much larger land area. It has a larger population. It is technologically much more advanced than Iraq. Iran is its nuclear program is much more advanced than Iraq's was. They have been taking steps to protect their enrichment program. They're putting it in caves under mountains, for example, and they're dispersing it to make it more difficult to attack. We're also talking geographically that it's twice as far from Tel Aviv as Iraq was, making it more difficult for Israeli bombers to attack. And even if they did, because of the dispersion of the technology and because of the hardening of the technology, you have the specter of the former head of Shabbat, which would be roughly the equivalent of the CIA and the Mossad. Also, the former director of the Mossad just last year, both of them within the last week have come out and said that the Israeli government, the Netanyahu-led government, and Ehud Barak are crazy. They are delusional. They are deluded. It's the stupidest idea I ever heard. This is what the two most recent high-level Israeli intelligence generals publicly said last week. So I really take heart, because in a sense, they're also very high-level whistleblowers. These are not quote Arab lovers. They're not soft on Iran in any way, and they've come out publicly and they said this is crazy. And I think that most rational, logical observers of the scene would say that the idea of attacking Iran is absolutely crazy, because if depending on how Iran would react, it certainly would in all probability would be able to close the Straits of Hormuz, would be able to destroy the Saudi oil shipping facilities. That would just be for a starter. It's just mind-boggling that it's even considered. But both the U.S. government and Israel have gone way, way out on a limb with the propaganda now. And the Iranian people are really, really hurting because of these sanctions that have taken place, these oil sanctions and now, proposed sanctions about selling Iran gasoline. The situation is not good. It's very volatile. and even if everybody really doesn't want to have war, that this is all posturing in order to gain leverage over Iran and that it's all a big game, well, we all know that a lot of times there are unintended consequences. And in this case, the consequences could lead to and include use of nuclear weapons and even potentially, you know, World War III with nuclear weapons.
So we absolutely know Pakistan has a substantial nuclear arsenal with delivery systems. We know India has a substantial nuclear arm system with delivery system. We know Israel has it. We know South Africa definitely has a bomb, but delivery systems we don't know.
South Africa has destroyed their bombs.
Okay.
They're the only nation in the world that actually gives out nuclear weapons and destroyed them. So that's a very admirable thing. When we look at the nuclear arsenals today, I guess we could start with North Korea. North Korea has conducted 3 tests of nuclear devices with, you know, it's a misnomer to call them nuclear weapons. And in any serious scientific way, each one of these so-called nuclear tests has been a spectacular failure. All of them essentially were nuclear fizzles, and certainly they've not mastered miniaturization technology. So in that sense, I think, in my opinion, we can dismiss North Korea as, you know, any type of a meaningful nuclear actor. We have China and France. China and France each have around in the vicinity of, we don't know exactly, but 350 nuclear weapons, and they have, you know, somewhat sophisticated delivery systems. In the case of China, they actually only have several dozen ICBMs capable of reaching the west coast of the U.S., and those are all liquid-fueled, which take days to fuel. So we have Israel somewhere in there. The estimates range from 200 would be the conventional estimate, and that goes all the way back to 1986. Up to as many as 500. Dan Ellsberg and others have estimated that they have as many as 500. The actual number doesn't matter because they certainly have hundreds, in my opinion, and according to virtually every credible authoritative source, these are very highly sophisticated, miniaturized weapons with a very sophisticated delivery system. So I would put Israel at a par or, in terms of technology, even more advanced than China and France. Britain has gotten rid of most of its nuclear weapons. It has fewer than 200 now. And then, of course, the big boys then India has perhaps 150 nuclear weapons. India, the listeners may remember maybe 2 weeks ago, launched their first short-range intercontinental ballistic missile. So that puts it in the club with the United States, Russia, Britain, and China and France. And then Pakistan, of course, you know, responded immediately with their own intermediate range missiles. So India has 150 weapons. Pakistan has maybe 75 to 100 weapons, more cruder and much less of a sophisticated delivery system. And then the big boys, you have Russia, which has the most nuclear weapons now, probably, but we also have to look at qualitative edge and Russia's nuclear system is pretty crude compared to the U.S. It's also, because of the collapse of the Soviet Union, is in a state of great disrepair. Yeah. In the meantime, you have the U.S. System. So even though the United States has been reducing the number of nuclear weapons, signing these arms control agreements, it's always on our terms so that that we are getting rid of nuclear missiles, nuclear bombers that we feel they're obsolete. So there's always going to be an effort to try to maintain a first strike advantage vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. But of course, when we're talking about, you know, the thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons on either side, we're still talking, you know, about enough nuclear power to end life on Earth as we know it. So that's the situation. And, you know, and if war breaks out, if Israel attacks Iran, and that involves, you know, Pakistan or India or Russia, you know, who knows what could happen? It's just not a scenario that I'd like to think about.
Absolutely frightening. I don't know if anybody's got any comments or suggestions or observations. If you want to give us a call, it'd be fantastic. 888-874-4888. Again, anybody wants to call in, suggest observations, recommendations, experiences, 888-874-4888. My producer will put you right on in. John, this is, it's mind-boggling. You know, I've read about this and I've known about, but the amount of research you've done and the information you have, your attempts to resolve the problems, I mean, thank God for you that you're out there and doing it. How do you perceive the American public, or what do you see the American public's knowledge of all this, and what do you see Israelis' knowledge of it, again, the Iranian public's knowledge, and then where do the governments fall into all this right now? What are the intents, or what's happening, or what can we anticipate?
The Iranian public's knowledge is much more acutely attuned and I think accurate than Israeli and the public opinion, public knowledge, and especially the American public understanding of the situation. So in Iran, every time Netanyahu speaks, every time Congress passes another piece of anti-Iranian legislation, there's a lot of commentary, there's a lot of analysis through the Iranian press. We need to remember that Iran, in terms of the Middle East region, that Iran is in many ways the most open, where people are, you know, able to listen and to express themselves, compared to, say, for example, Saudi Arabia or Syria or other nations in the region. So the Iranian public is pretty well informed and very, very concerned about the situation. In Israel, the propaganda is, Iran represents an existential threat, and, you know, we are so good, and our Air Force is so powerful, and our soldiers and our airmen are so competent that, you know, we can strike, we can issue a surgical strike, and it'll be all over very quickly. There'll be no response. Iran is not going to be foolish enough to respond, and it's going to be no problem at all. And a large percentage of the Israeli population believes that. In the U.S., the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of the American public believes that Iran either has an active nuclear weapons program and is on the verge of developing nuclear weapons, or they believe that Iran already has nuclear weapons. They're very concerned about it. On the other hand, significant numbers of the American public remember the lies that were promulgated in Iraq, and there is a large anti-war sentiment that is not eager to go to war with Iran. You know, on the other hand, the U.S. public is, you know, abysmally ignorant about the real situation.
What do you see as far as our Congress is involved?
Well, part of the issue with Congress is that virtually any time any resolution comes up that it either is actively pursued by the Israeli government or is perceived by Congress as supported by the Israeli government, that these resolutions pass, and they don't just pass, you know, with a majority. They pass with an overwhelming majority. So the recent sanctions legislation that's been passed against Iran has passed, with only a handful of votes against it. In some cases, some progressive Democrats, and then some libertarian Republicans like Ron Paul and a few others have voted against it. But don't get me wrong. You know, we need to continue to bring pressure to bear on the Obama administration, and to particularly on the Congress. But we also need to, you know, face the reality that it's an uphill struggle. We need to bring pressure to bear in any way that we can. So, supporting Occupy is one way. Protesting is another way. Speaking out, becoming informed on these issues. I didn't set out to become an expert on the Israeli nuclear program. It just kind of fell in my lap. I'm just a citizen journalist. I don't get paid for this. It's kind of like paying your dues for being human. So I think that, if you want to lobby Congress, then by all means, let's lobby Congress. If direct action is what you need to do, then let's do that. If it's research and writing and or developing documentaries, let's do that.
But John, thank you very much. It's an incredibly informative thing. I'd like to have you back again, sir, and please keep in touch and keep up your good work, sir. Thank you very much. Anyhow, this is Warrior Connection, Progressive Radio Network. As we said, we're moving forward. John, you had a last comment. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll see you again next week on Warrior Connection with the Progressive Radio Network. Have a good evening.